Good evening. This is Tom Duggan with the latest sports news and views. We also have a special guest tonight, Jim Hurlbut, NBC reporter at large, who'll tell us something of the big 500-mile Memorial Day race at Indianapolis yesterday. But first, let's take a look-see at the spot sports news as it happened today. Only two afternoon games were played in the major leagues. Three games are scheduled in the National League tonight, with Brooklyn at St. Louis and New York at Cincinnati in a twilight night doubleheader. All-American League games are night contests. Chicago is at New York, and St. Louis is at Washington. Cleveland at Boston, Detroit at Philadelphia were postponed because of rain. This afternoon, the Chicago Cubs drew beat on Kurt Simmons and the Philadelphia Phillies out at Wrigley Field, but couldn't get the ball into the cross sides to prevent Philadelphia batters from beating the proverbial pitching brains out of starting pitcher Frankie Hiller. Hiller set the third-place Phils down in order in the first inning, but then ran into a cannonade of five hits plus a walk in the second inning to go to the showers, leaving his teammates down and practically out by the score of 5-0. The game continued, as games generally do, with this one low-lighted by three Roy Smalley errors. The Cubs managed to collect four runs along the route, but the final score was Philadelphia 8, Chicago 4. Kurt Simmons, the winning pitcher, gets my vote, is firing the fastest ball in the major leagues today. Just about everything happened today at Pittsburgh, where the Boston Braves swamped the Pirates 14-2. It was the ninth defeat in a row for Pittsburgh, and that gives the Pirates their longest losing streak in 16 years. Not only that, but the Pirate pitching staff reached its lowest point in the fifth inning when reserve first baseman Jackie Phillips came on to hurl. At that, Phillips didn't do nearly as badly as his three Pirate mound predecessors. Jackie gave up seven hits and four runs in the five innings he toiled, while the Braves got 11 hits and nine runs off Mel Queen, Bob Chestnut, and Jim Walsh in the four frames they worked. For the Braves, Sid Gordon walloped his ninth home run of the season with the bases full in the first inning, and Bob Elliott smacked his ninth of the season in the third with one on. It was Gordon's second Grand Slam homer of the season. Vern Bickford went all the way for Boston, allowing only seven widely spaced hits and racking up his fourth victory of the season. Boston Red Sox slugger Ted Williams denied today a published report that he wants to be traded to any one of three teams who only wished the story was true. A copyright story in the New York Post under the byline of Jimmy Cannon declared Williams was sick of Boston's hostile and abusive baseball fanatics. But the game's highest paid player retorted, "The story is absolutely false. I would not play for anybody but Tom, Red Sox owner Yawkey. I do not know how the story started, but I want to vehemently deny that I said any such thing." General Manager Joe Cronin of the Red Sox labeled the report a pipe dream, as did officials of the Detroit Tigers and Cleveland Indians, two of the teams mentioned as Williams' possible postseason destinations. Officials of the other club, the New York Yankees, declined all comment. A spokesman said, "You cannot expect us to say anything about another man's ball player." General Manager Billy Evans of the Tigers said the same thing, although when asked if Williams' salary might stop the Tigers from seeking his services, he snapped, "Salary never kept us from getting a player we wanted." As for Hank Greenberg, General Manager of the Indians, he sighed wistfully that he would be glad to have Williams. Then, thinking it over, he added, "Who wouldn't?" Kerry Middlecoff, the National Open Golf Champion, took a one-stroke lead in the $15,000 Fort Wayne Open Tournament with a 5-under par 66 in the first round today. The field was tightly bunched, with 18 players shooting better than the par 71 on the 6,400-yard Orchard Ridge Country Club course. Herman Kaiser of Lima, Ohio, and Lloyd Mangren of Chicago, not to mention Ed Oliver of Kenmore, Washington, were a stroke behind Middlecoff at 67. Ted Kroll of New Hartford, Connecticut, and Skip Alexander of Knoxville, Tennessee, had 68s. Better-known names in the par-plus bracket included Jim Ferrier of San Francisco at 72, one over par, Dick Metz of Virginia Beach, Virginia at 74, two over, and Jimmy DeMeritt of Ojai, California at 75. Coach Frank Leahy, who's led Notre Dame through four consecutive undefeated football seasons, denied reports today for the umpteenth time that he's leaving the Irish to coach the professional Los Angeles Rams. Leahy, in a telephone conversation from New York, declared, "I've definitely decided that all my coaching will be done at Notre Dame. I've never considered coaching the Los Angeles Rams, and I won't in the future." Leahy's statement was made in an effort to spike recurring reports that he's leaving his Notre Dame post. One such report was published in Detroit today. Since Coach Leahy is definitely staying at Notre Dame, he'll be cheered to hear this news. 45-year-old Leo Del Grosso of Chicago has promised to furnish the Fighting Irish of Notre Dame with two Italian football players with the aid of $69,792 recently arrived from Ireland. Del Grossa, who won that sum in the Irish sweepstakes, told reporters that the money is staying in the bank until his two sons, Leo Jr., age 15, and Daniel, 13, are ready to enter Notre Dame. Furthermore, Del Grossa declared, the salesmen who have been pestering him with various and sundry projects for the money may as well give up. He said, I tell every one of them I sold the Brooklyn Bridge 20 years ago, and I don't want to buy it back right now. Del Grossa, a $65 a week bartender, won the money on March 25th and disclosed today that it has already arrived and has been stashed away. He admitted that Uncle Sam will get a substantial cut of the winnings in taxes, but says the remainder will be saved until his sons are ready for college. Del Grossa said, then Notre Dame will get two Italian football players. Leo was at Mount Carmel, and Dan now at Our Lady of Peace. Arrangements are being made next week. The University of Michigan's great halfback in 1947, Bob Chappius, says he's all finished with professional football. Chappius never approached the stardom in pro ball that he gained in the college ranks. He played with the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1948 and the Chicago Hornets last year. Both clubs have been dissolved. Ike Armstrong, who has coached University of Utah football teams for 25 years, finally has won his Ute letter. Ike, who was a star fullback at Drake University until his graduation in 1923, was given the coveted U at a farewell banquet last night. He will go to the University of Minnesota July 1st to become director of athletics. Turning now to the turf, an 8-1 shot adaptable won a photo finish today in the $7,500 Corinthian Steeplechase Handicap at Belmont. The camera showed adaptable the winner over second place Hot. Monkey Wrench was third in the field of seven jumpers. The scratches included Elk Ridge, the 12-year-old gelding, which has won more money than any other steeplechase horse. Adaptable is the 9-year-old bay from the Happy Hill Farm. It's the first win for the gelding since April. He ran the course about 2 miles in 4 minutes and 3 seconds flat. That's 23 seconds off the track record, a long way off. Adaptable carried 141 pounds, which included veteran jockey Pete Smithwick. Incidentally, if your dog is losing in a greyhound race, why not just turn off the switch that makes the electric pacing rabbit run? At West Houghton Stadium in London, somebody did. All bets, of course, were returned, and sorrowful track officials are still untangling the greyhounds. Contestants in the National Open Golf Championship next week at Ardmore, Pennsylvania, have been warned to speed up their game. If they don't, the U.S. Golf Association is liable to do something drastic about it. USGA Secretary Joe Day says, if the boys don't speed it up, there might be summary disqualifications of several, or at least some painful stroke penalties. Day says that in last year's Open, some of the threesomes took more than 4 hours to complete their 18-hole round. He believes 3 hours is plenty of time, even 3 hours and 1 minute. And, says Day, the time has come when we simply must act if the game is not to be seriously injured. The thing is getting completely out of hand. And here's a sports shorty with a kind of a moral, of some kind anyway. Perseverance won out today for golfer Jay McNichol. He scored a hole-in-one. He's been trying for 55 years at Sydney, Australia. A record prize of $57,458.63 was paid tonight to Johnny Parsons of Van Nuys, California, and his yellow race car for winning the 34th 500-mile race at Indianapolis yesterday. It was the top prize out of a purse of $199,435 announced by the Indianapolis Motor Speedway at its victory dinner for the drivers. The Speedway added a $58,000 bonus to its $75,000 guaranteed race purse. And besides that, $133,000, the prize fund included $8,300 in qualification prizes, $13,600 in refunded entry fees, accessories valued at $24,525, and $20,010 in lap prizes. I hope you wrote all that down. Because rain ended the race at 138 laps, that's 345 miles, the lap prize fund paid off at $145. In a full 500-mile event, drivers are paid $100 for every lap they lead. The champion's purse topped the $52,100 paid to Billy Arnold in 1930. Billy, I believe, led for something like 197 laps of the 200 in that particular race. Bill Holland won $51,575 last year. All prizes are actually paid to the car owner, and the driver's share is a private deal between the two. The usual split is 60% for the owner and 40% for the driver. And Parsons' prizes for winning the race brought him $32,500 from the Speedway purse. He got $16,820 more in lap prizes, $100 in qualifying, and $412, not to mention 12 cents, as his entry fee refund. The rest of the prize was in accessories. Besides these prizes, the champion also got the Mercury pace car, various trophies, a Cocker Spaniel pup, a set of tools, a ring, a portrait of himself, and free meals at an Indianapolis restaurant for a year. Not to mention four kisses from Barbara Stanwyck, the movie star. Incidentally, Barbara says that Johnny kisses better than Clark Gable. Well, pass me another. Well, now for our question and answer eyewitness account of the 500-mile Memorial Day race at Indianapolis. In our studios tonight is Jim Hurlbut, NBC's reporter at large, who covered the classic for NBC and the Camel News Caravan. Jim, it's nice having you with us.
Thank you, Tom. It's nice to be here.
Well, Jim, let's put aside all these things about saying hello to each other and get right down to the crux of the problem, why you're here. How do you feel about Johnny Parsons winning the shortened 500-miler?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about it that he was out in front from the ninth lap on with that big yellow car of his with the big number one up on the side. He passed Maury Rose without any difficulty at the ninth lap, and he stayed out in front a good part of the time. There was one occasion when Rose briefly was out in front, and later on, of course, when Johnny Parsons went to the pit, Holland came up in front for a couple of laps. But generally speaking, he rode the kind of a race that was definitely sure to win the 345-mile short 500-mile race.
Well, now, you say he definitely won the 345-mile race. Do you feel that if he continued for the 500 that he's been able to stay on top of the pack?
I'm going to take a little exception there, if I might, Tom, from my personal observation. I think Maury Rose was driving the kind of a race that was aimed at a 500-mile event. At the time of the calling of the race, he was laying back in third position. You'll remember at first we thought that he was back in fifth.
That's right.
But that was the lap timers who observed by eye and not the electric timer. When they checked the electric timer, they discovered that actually he'd been passed during the caution period by the two drivers who were earlier called in second and third place. And I think that he was laying back deliberately in that third place and had a lot left to come up in that last 155 miles.
Well, now, about Bill Holland, who finished on top last year and in front of Maury Rose this year, what would his chance have been at finishing on top for the 500 miles?
Of course, it's anybody's guess, as you know. That last 150 miles is the hardest. That's when you come down to that pilot fatigue problem. Everybody's tired. It's a long and grueling race, and it's the last 150 miles that possibly tells the story not only for drivers but for cars as well, because the cars break down a lot more frequently in the last 150 miles than they do in the first 150 miles, or let's say the middle 150.
They get tired just like humans do.
They certainly do, and we saw it down there.
Well, how about it? Was it a safe race, Jim?
You know, a lot of people said they were disappointed because there weren't a lot of accidents in the race. Personally, I think it was a very good race from that point of view. We only had two minor mishaps until the caution period on the northeast turn. That's the considered to be one of the most dangerous turns on the course. We did have a couple of skids. One of them was a slow skid by car 67 driven by Schindler. And right after that, car 77 came around and skidded into the infield and back out onto the track. It might have been a more serious accident if it hadn't been for that first skid, because the officials were out with the caution flag, the yellow caution flag, and slowed the other cars down in time to keep them from crashing into 77, which was on the track broadside at that particular moment.
Well, how about that storm, Jim, that came up? Could you see that coming in the distance?
Well, we could see that storm, Tom, from about, well, I can't tell you in miles, but let's say an hour and a half away. And everybody kept a weather eye on it. It was a beautiful day in Indianapolis, as you know, up until the time the storm arrived. But up there in the northeast was this black cloud hanging down. And I don't know what happened after the storm arrived, because I took off from the Speedway, went over to Shanks Airfield to get into a plane, come up with the pictures of the race, and we flew around that storm. It didn't look too big, but it was certainly big enough to stop the race. They'll take chances, but not the kind of chances you take on wet bricks.
Well, that would have been suicide, wouldn't it?
Oh, even at 90 miles an hour, they had a couple crash into the wall.
Well, Jim, we enjoyed your Camel News Caravan pictures and commentary on that very much. I thought you did a marvelous job on it. And I also want to thank you a lot for stopping up this evening to tell us all about it.
Tom, it's always pleasant to be in your company.
Thank you, Jim Hurlbut, NBC's reporter at large. And that about wraps up the sports picture for the moment, fans. So until tomorrow night, same time, same station, this is Tom Duggan saying goodnight. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.